But DDCC was formed back in September of 1990 when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made public its intent to list the Louisiana black bear subspecies as threatened under the guidelines of the Endangered Species Act. And those of you that have gray hair will remember that this was the height of the controversy associated with the spotted owl in the Pacific Northwest, and endangered species issues were quite contentious and polarized, and there were a number of interests in the state that feared that we could end up with another type of polarized scenario here. One big difference in this region and that in the Pacific Northwest is 90% of the real estate in Louisiana and surrounding states is privately owned, and Pacific Northwest, probably 80% of the real estate is publicly owned, and BLM lands or national forests and the like. And one of the things that I will talk about a little bit, and perhaps Jay will disagree, is that the Endangered Species Act is quite powerful law when there's a federal nexus. If it's on federal land, if you're using federal money or require a federal permit, then you have to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service if it's in habitat occupied by an endangered species. On private land with activities that require no federal money or no federal permit, you don't have to ask anybody's permission. You're not allowed to kill a listed species. You know, that draws a line. You can't kill, but one would argue that with a bear that is a generalist, that is quite mobile, whose home range might be for female 5,000 acres. I had a radio collared bear in 92 whose normal home range was 120,000 acres. So pretty much moved all over Point Coupee Parish. And so one could argue it would take a pretty sizable project for the service to deny a permit. That's certainly the perspective they've got. So we got started before it was listed, because we knew that it was going to be listed, by trying to engage as many stakeholders as we possibly could in the discussion. The timber company biologists were particularly fearful of a listing, thinking that, again, most of us didn't know anything about the Endangered Species Act other than what we've been reading about Pacific Northwest and spotted owls. So we got together and started a meeting. And I didn't realize then, and I get reminded even now, that some of these laws, like Endangered Species Acts, can come under a lot of political influence. And at the time that the bear was listed, we had a very powerful U.S. Senator, Senator J. Bennett Johnson. And again, things that the Fish and Wildlife Service was doing in the Pacific Northwest didn't seem to be working. The politicians were catching a lot of flack over how things weren't working. Senator Johnson had what I consider a brilliant chief of staff, I think was her title, a woman named Laura Hudson, who, when I was in there in her office one day, when she called Dick Smith, who was the deputy director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, and said, Senator Johnson, who was, again, chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, thinks that Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't done a very good job, and quite honestly, you've made a mess of a lot of endangered species related issues, so we're going to give these new guys a chance. We're going to give them a chance to screw it up. So that kind of forced the Fish and Wildlife Service to back off and gave us the, I won't call it authority because we really had no authority, but it gave us the go-ahead to do whatever we were going to do. And quite honestly, we didn't know what we were going to do. We had people at the table who represented corporate timber interests. We had the environmental community. We had landowner interests. Everybody at the table. We had people who supported the listing of Louisiana black bear. I was one who felt at that time that, you know, you list the species under the Endangered Species Act, by God, you're going to save it. It's going to work. And then you had biologists who felt that, you know, if we were going to restore bears, it was going to mostly be on private land. That's mostly what we have. And that if it was listed, that the private landowners would not embrace any kind of restoration of a federal listed species that might, down the road, impact their ability to do whatever they want to do, harvest timber, whatever. So there was a lot of disagreement, but we all agreed we wanted to do something to help the bear. Now, the timber company boys wanted to do something to help the bear to prevent it from being listed. And this was not a secret. And then others of us who wanted to list the bear, because we had this thing, well, once it's listed, you know, everything will be fine. But, and we really felt that once it was listed, that the timber company people would leave, because that isn't what they wanted. But there was actually something called a 4D rule when it was listed, January 7th, 1992. For the first time, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service promulgated as a part of the listing document what's called a 4D rule, which is in Section 4D of the Endangered Species Act that allows for you to make certain exemptions to the takings provisions of the Endangered Species Act. So when the listing came out, and the bear wasn't listed as threatened, but with this 4D rule that allowed for silvicultural, normal silvicultural activities to be exempt from the takings provisions of the law. So that was seen by the timber company boys as a good faith effort on the part of the government, and it kept them at the table. And we were real excited about that because the timber companies at the table gave us the opportunity to come up with some financial resources that the rest of us weren't going to be able to pony up. And so we and these timber company people were all wildlife biologists. So we're talking about some people who were pretty knowledgeable about wildlife management, but also the people who are at the table, and I have to give them credit, they were some of the most progressive wildlife biologists in the country. If you look at who hires the wildlife biologists, it's those corporate things that have the money to hire the best that that money can buy. But we had some really, really good ones. And they represented, you know, International Paper, who had 10 million acres. Anderson Tully Company, who was the largest owner of bottom and hardwood habitat in the lower Mississippi River Valley, and the only landowner, corporate landowner, that really had bears on their property. And Georgia Pacific, a number. But they all stayed there. They all helped pony up money that we then matched with NIFWIF dollars and stuff like that to come up with literally tens of thousands of dollars to initiate bear research with the Louisiana black bear. Prior to this, there had only been one graduate project in the mid-70s done on Louisiana black bear. So the knowledge of Louisiana black bear was pretty low. In fact, the knowledge of bears in this state was pretty low. You know, 92, after it was listed, LSU had a professor that did get involved in some bear research. But I didn't know anything about bears. Nothing. I read everything, only to find out later that a lot of what I read wasn't even true. That we proved a lot of that to be not the best information, if you will. But we hit the ground running because we felt like, you know, we had the go-ahead from Fish and Wildlife Service and our congressional delegation, and I went up regularly to brief our congressional delegation about what we were doing. So we pooled the resources we had, which were considerable. At the time, Fish and Wildlife Service in Lafayette had 9 employees, and we had 3 times that many biologists working with us. So we were able to do way more than they did. And one of the first things that we did was come up with a restoration plan for bears in the region. And the historic range for Louisiana black bears, all of Louisiana, lower two-thirds of Mississippi, a pretty good-sized chunk of East Texas, and just lower Arkansas. So we came up with this recovery plan, which is quite ambitious, that suggests we wanted 5 sustainable bear subpopulations of bears throughout the region, 3 in Louisiana, probably 1 in Mississippi, although we didn't specify it, and 1 in Texas. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service took this document and came up with their official recovery plan. The criteria in the recovery plan for delisting, if we're going to talk a little bit about delisting, but it calls for 2 sustainable populations, and at the time this was written, and I don't know if the science that's out there today still supports that the minimum viable population is 80 to 100 bears in a subpopulation. But this recovery plan calls for 2 sustainable populations connected with forested corridors connecting the 2, with evidence of immigration and emigration, so you get some genetic exchange between those 2 populations, and reasonable protection for those forested corridors and habitats that are occupied by Louisiana black bear. So that's the criteria that the government has put in their recovery plan to, which will determine if and when Louisiana black bear will be delisted. While we're looking at that thing, recognizing again that 90% of the habitat's private. At the time of listing, the Tensaw River National Wildlife Refuge had a bear population no one really knew how big, but pretty much all the other bears in the state were on private property. So we wrote a management handbook, landowner management handbook. So not only does it give landowners a brief lesson of the biology about bears and, you know, everything we knew about bears at the time, quite honestly, but it also gave them a list of incentive programs associated with USDA mostly, and how to deal with nuisance bears. It had all the contact numbers, you know, to call if you have a problem or you want to restore property. I mean, there's information here about the Nature Conservancy, land trusts, Fish and Wildlife Service, Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, Mississippi, Texas, Arkansas, all of that stuff. This has been a tremendous document. This is the third printing of the document. I'm currently editing it for our fourth edition. So we've probably given 25,000 of these out to landowners and other folks in the region. So for a number of years, you know, I did nuisance bear work. I did whatever, you know, I mean, whatever I was asked to do, you know, we were always there if it related to bears. So we got involved in a lot of different things. But one of the things that, and I've mentioned to Jay yesterday and today, is I've been pretty disappointed that, you know, the Endangered Species Act doesn't really provide the protections that most of us think it does. Like I say, if your land is private, and I'm a landowner, and I am certainly a supporter of the rights of private landowners, but if we're going to do anything in this region that of substance when it comes to wildlife conservation, it's going to happen on private land. So we've got to come up with incentives, if you will, that give private landowners a sense of, you know, what's in it for me, if you will, but how does it benefit landowners? We can't expect landowners to do things that aren't in their best interest to benefit society. I would do it, but a lot of people won't. I mean, we're talking about an animal whose range is thousands of acres, and one thing bears need that was lacking in 1990 is a lot of real estate. The Endangered Species Act provides no incentives for much of anything, and certainly not habitat restoration. We recognize that one of the things that needed to be done was restoration of the bottomland hardwood system, of which 80% had been converted to other uses. And fortunately, while we're trying to rally all this together, the 1990 Farm Bill came into came through Congress, establishing something called a Wetland Reserve Program, which actually paid the owners of marginal agricultural lands with certain hydric characteristics. Would pay them appraised value of their land and reforest it in exchange for a perpetual easement on that property. So in Louisiana, since 1992, we've planted 261,000 and change acres of bottomland hardwood habitat. And at least that much or a little bit more has been planted in Mississippi, and at least that much or a little bit more has been planted in Arkansas. Just with Wetland Reserve Program. So we're talking 800,000 acres of bottomland hardwood habitat that's been restored through the Wetland Reserve Program. Then you have Conservation Reserve Program, which is not a perpetual easement program, but it's a rental program where landowners are paid a rental fee, and there's easily another 800,000. It's actually at one point there was 900,000 acres just in Mississippi. And I don't know exactly how many acres are under contract with CRP right now, because those contracts last 15 years, and then once, you know, the contract's over, then they're dropped from the rolls. But our what we've seen over the years is these people, these landlords plant and get paid to plant trees, and they let them grow for 15 years, they're pretty much gonna let it stay in forest. They're not gonna go in and clear that land. Now that commodity prices are as high as they are, and they're very, very high, it kind of throws a different set of rules out there. And I'm not sure what the long-term implications or even the short-term implications of those are, other than I can tell you right now, we're having a very difficult time. Natural Resources Conservation Service in most parishes that aren't already capped out, but Point Coupee we'll use as an example, will pay $1,700 an acre for an easement on marginal farmland. We got some money from Walton Foundation to we can piggyback another $100 an acre incentive, and then we've entered into an agreement with the Nature Conservancy, who got $5 or $6 million from Disney for carbon easements, so we can piggyback that on top of that. So we're trying to make it, again, in the landowner's best interest to take that marginal farmland and put it back in the trees. We have realized that with prices as there are, we shouldn't go to landowners who are farming, say, 1,000 acres and say, we want to put your 1,000 acres into trees. If you want to do it, we'd be glad to do it. But, you know, can we have 100 acres down this side that borders this riparian area? Because they would like to see the bear delisted. And it's just the fear of the unknown, again, associated with the Endangered Species Act. So that's kind of the direction we're going, and we're looking at an area through Point Coupee Parish that has a lot of grazing lands in it, not necessarily soybean and corn, and now a lot of sugar cane's being grown there. So, we're always communicating with as many people as we can to figure out how do we do this? You know, what's going to work? And one of the good things that's come out of it, historically, and I've been involved with nonprofit organizations for a long, long time, and historically, we have not seen a lot of collaboration, cooperation among the different groups. We all tend to go off on our own and do whatever we do. But this scenario is kind of affording an opportunity for us to partner, like with the Nature Conservancy, who, they got plenty of money. You don't usually deal with somebody like me who has none. So it's some good things that are evolving out of that, but we still don't know if it's going to work. And I think we'll probably touch on, but I'm going to let Jay talk first, but talk about delisting.